All right, you're welcome back to the program. Watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix. It's scary. It's about social media. Another caller says, regarding the campaign to bring people back to Donegal, this sounds fantastic. And like Greg, there's no place I'd rather be. The reality, however, is challenging for those in employment, i.e. cost of childcare and cost of living in general. So much more needs to be done for working families. If you take unpaid parental leave, obviously you're on a reduced wage, but still have childcare to pay. There needs to be an incentive to work rather than to build a job. And I get what you're saying, but a lot of the challenges aren't unique to here. Some of them are unique. And you know what? We should be screaming from the rooftops if we can. That come here because it's better. I still genuinely do believe it is. But as I say, I recognise all the challenges as you've outlined there. Joel Gilmore is CEO of Ireland West Airport in Knock. Good morning to you, Joe.
Good morning, Greg, and to all your listeners.
How's everyone down in beautiful Ireland West Airport?
We're all very good, Greg, and delighted with the news yesterday that Aer Lingus have launched a new Heathrow service from us, commencing on March the 26th.
You never had to put those tents outside to accommodate the queues in Ireland West, did you? I mean, it's a smooth transition from the car park to the airport and to your onward destination. That's it's brilliant, that airport, in that regard.
It's one of the benefits of being a regional airport with I guess not the same challenges as our larger city airports, but it's one of the I guess ease of use and convenience for passengers using the airport is one of the key parts of the whole trip here.
How significant is Aer Lingus announcing this flight from Ireland West Airport, Knock, to London Heathrow? And we often focus on the outward journey, but we can never underestimate how important it is to have connections into Ireland, into the west of Ireland particularly. That's hugely important, especially presumably as we head towards the summer. But to get into Heathrow from Knock, is that particularly significant?
I tell you, I'm not being smart now, but we're certainly going to find out shortly. In the airport's 37-year history, probably top of the list in terms of priorities has been to have connectivity into an international major hub. And slots in Heathrow, as you probably know, are like gold dust, and it's extremely difficult for airports of our scale to achieve a slot. So from that perspective, I hate the word game changer, but for us, it's opening up a whole new marketplace.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's, I think people get that because obviously if you're going to fly somewhere else or you want to connect, if you fly to one of the outlying London airports, they're grand if you're going in to visit the city or what have you. But this means that people will look as a viable option, say, right, I've got better options out of London and I can fly from Knock straight in there and fly out from within the same airport. But it's a suck it and see at this stage, is it, Joe?
The stats and the information, you know, available in terms of the research highlight that, you know, there are tens of thousands of passengers in the region that travel to other airports to take Heathrow services to connect onwards. So, like, if you take the Aer Lingus IAG network alone, they have 6 partner airlines. So, like, as of yesterday, you can book on British Airways, American, Air Canada, Iberia, JetBlue, United, and we're right up there now on the booking screen, both inbound and outbound. So, you know, we're expecting... It's difficult to put a finger on the transfer traffic that will initially, I think people will, first of all, have to try it. You know, you'll be able to seamlessly check in here now with a through ticket to basically most destinations across the globe. Through the IAG network alone, Aer Lingus and BA will be offering 80 destinations, and that's covering the US, Middle East, Africa, Asia, and so forth. So connected, it's a lunchtime service as well, which we're delighted to get. They're very difficult ones to get, but the service will land in here just after lunchtime and be back in Heathrow at about just after 2 o'clock. So it gives you a very wide range of connectivity after. And likewise on the inbound, it's a morning service inbound, so people arriving on early morning flights into Heathrow have great connectivity straight back into the west.
Yeah, and we'll talk a bit about the advantages of that. Obviously, though, you have to look at the bigger picture. The airline does as well as yourselves. There are those that might have been quite comfortable and familiar with the London Gatwick route. This is replacing that. That will terminate on the 25th of March. Now, there might be some customers already booked on that. They'll be rebooked, presumably, into Heathrow. But look, you have to look at the bigger picture and see what, you know, this new, more central as well as international connectivity, all the advantages of that over maybe just commoding some into Gatwick?
No, that's a very fair point, Greg. And we recognise that we've had a very loyal customer base using the Gatwick service over the last 15 years. And it's evident, you know, with comments back on Facebook and so forth, that this isn't, you know, ideally. And what we had hoped and sought for is both services to run concurrently for a period of time. However, in this situation with Aer Lingus in particular, it hasn't been feasible. Mm. It's not to say that we won't be now looking for replacement airlines on the Gatwick
service. And look, you know what? You talk about social media reaction. The reality is that it's inevitable that more people who are upset at Gatwick they're going to post. People aren't going to post, oh, this is lovely about Heathrow. Those motivated are those that feel discommoded. So social media doesn't necessarily give you exact read of the situation.
What we do hope, Greg, is that Aer Lingus have, you know, committed to offering people that are discommoded in Gatwick a transfer onto the Heathrow service. With the connectivity out of Heathrow, and I know it's a major airport, with the, you know, the access to the Gatwick Express, the new Elizabethan line, the tube and all that, we hope people will at least try the Heathrow service, and hopefully they'll find that it's maybe not as difficult or as cumbersome as they may expect.
But look, if you want to go in and see London, or you want to fly somewhere else, you know, Heathrow is the airport, no harm to Gatwick. I mean, and you know what I mean, it's you can get on a train and you are in the heart of it really, really quickly.
That's correct. As I said, Heathrow, there is a defined marketplace around Gatwick, and it certainly is going to be a service we're going to try and reinstate.
I haven't given up on it
this year, but I think certainly moving forward, there's a marketplace there for it as well.
Yeah, so. the inbound traffic, as I say, you know, I think that's really important too, because what it does is it connects the west of Ireland for people who might, you know, be looking for a weekend away or something, you know. So hopefully it has a positive inward tourism effect.
I think it will. And again, that's a whole new ballgame for us, if you like, because we haven't had that hub connectivity through Heathrow. We know from empirical data that some of our other regional colleagues down the coast that have Heathrow services in place, they can get up to between 30 to 50% transfer traffic on their Heathrow services inbound, on the inbound leg from the US, and from the, you know, like you can fly from Abu Dhabi over here, you can fly literally any part of the world now through Heathrow. So it's going to be very exciting for us to see the spread of traffic. The challenge we have, and just it will be a call out to the community across your region, and particularly businesses, we are acutely aware, and the business community have always saw the Heathrow service in terms of hub connectivity. We'd ask them to take a serious look at this service now, because it's in place, it's a daily service. We really want it to be a tremendous success. Heathrow slots are extremely difficult to get, and even more difficult to hold on to.
And Aer Lingus will be looking at the capacity on the flight as well too. They're a business. Exactly. They have to make calls. It's not quite use it or lose it, but it sounds to me we're in that space that, you know, you want this to be a success.
Look at it, I won't pull any punches with it. They're very prized slots to get, and we are delighted to get it, and we have fought hard to get it. We're very confident it'll work, but I'm just throwing it out to the business community that do support the airport in every way they can, and I'm sure they will. I just have to say, finally, Greg, we already have, on a Friday here now for the summer, we'll have up to 5 London services a day between double dailies on Stansted and on Luton as well, in addition to the Heathrow. So I know your customer or your listener base is well aware of the routes, but we're trying to offer as much variety and options as possible.
You don't have to sugarcoat it. Unadulterated plugs are grand. It's all right, Joe. You're on. You know, push it. All right. Check out.
Listen, thank you very much.
Check it out and see if it suits you. Bye-bye. All right. Take care of yourself. Thank you very much. Joe Gilmore, CEO of Ireland West Airport at Knox. Oh, that's good. Yeah, it's good news, I suppose, in terms of connectivity into the region. But hopefully it's good news for... I've just been handed this, by the way. Does Joe see any end date for the €10 departure charge at the airport? I've asked that a couple of times. I think people see that that is in situ. It is the airport development charge, ongoing development, and they'd probably point to the retarmacking of the runway and all that type of stuff recently to justify that. It's funny. It is a thing It is a thing that bothers people. You know, they don't mind how much a breakfast might cost or this, that and then, but that €10 charge rubs people, some people, up the wrong way. Right, okay. I think it's great to encourage people to return home. However, I hope they bring totally realistic and honest when people inquire. I moved home 14 years ago and it was a totally different story for me. This was everything from getting insured to buying a house. Don't get me wrong. Spending time with family is fabulous and the scenery is breathtaking and there is nowhere nice on earth. But my quality of life is desperate here compared to living abroad. I bought a Mica house and I'm only waiting till the scheme gets going so I can get a house fixed and sell it so I can move away again. Ireland's so much different to what I was led to believe and living here is tough. And you've had it tough. You know, I mean, I presume you put everything into that house as well. It's just a big slap in the face from life, isn't it? So I fully get where you're talking from. Okay, welcome back to the programme. On to it, we welcome now Dave Brown, Secretary General of Ciall Éireann. Good morning to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Great to have you on the show. Right, this is a new organisation, though it sounds incredibly familiar. Tell us about why it was established, what it hopes to achieve.
Well, you know, I was pretty amiss to find, as were a lot of my colleagues, recently, and especially during the pandemic, we had lots of time to think about these things, that there's rather like the Irish Film Board or, you know, Bord Íoscovara, or there are, you know, main bodies and boards in Ireland set up to, you know, promote whatever industry they're set up to promote globally. And there isn't one for music. So we were a bit astonished to find that out. So it's pretty much in a nutshell what the Film Board has done for movies we want to do for music.
Is the industry a bit scattered at the moment, maybe? And even how funds are distributed or how one might apply for them, it's a bit convoluted and hit and miss and it's what you know and all that type of stuff. Are you hoping to maybe... Is that the case, firstly? And secondly, do you think this collective will help to fix that?
Well, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, there are certain sectors that are well funded. There's no denying that, and there are other sectors that are completely ignored. Look, and just to be clear, Greg, it's not a union. It's not a musicians' union. It's literally we're going to, you know, an official body that's set up to represent the music industry as a whole, the Irish music industry, both here and abroad. So for example, you know, rather like the GAA takes young people up through the ranks and all that, you know, young bands come up in Ireland, especially in contemporary music now, radio friendly, you know. Now, that's not to say we're not open to all genres of music, we are, but, you know, Irish music as a whole, and we've been punching above our weight for years in this regard in Ireland, is not really represented globally or in other countries, whereas a lot of other territories are. For example, UK music in England is designed to promote and do just that, sell UK music globally. Mm. And so that's what we want to do.
Is there a bit of an identity crisis in Irish music in that if you asked 1,000 people or 100 people for that matter, you know, define Irish music, do you think they would get it? Do you think they might say Irish music is either Nathan Carter or, you know, some other big pop act? Do you know what I mean? Like, do you think they would understand when we talk about Irish music what Irish music actually is? I mean, I'm not saying they aren't Irish music, by the way, but I just wonder if everyone gets really, you know, what it is.
Well, that is true, you know, and obviously we have hurdles we have to overcome. But I genuinely feel that, you know, if you have, for example, again, a young band coming up in Ireland that are really, really good, a radio friendly, let's say, pop rock band, you know, there's very little they can do in Ireland and they have very little access to proper information and proper funding, for that matter, and. You know, then as a consequence, we don't export it very well. So to answer your question, I know what you mean. I mean, and there, I have colleagues that would say, look, there's more to Irish music than whiskey in the jar, you know.
But I think also, too, I agree what you're talking about exporting, but we have to fix the problems that are in here as well. I think we do a good job here, but we're always trying to improve in terms of supporting Irish music. But some of it's a box-ticking exercise. You take Dermot Kennedy off the playlist nationally, right? And the amount of Irish music played is close to zero, right? He's doing all the heavy lifting in terms of, but you could say, oh, look, we're playing such and such a percentage of Irish music. Take Dermot Kennedy off your playlist, and don't, but take him off the playlist, and there's very little else there. They might throw in a token urban group or something or whatever, but in reality, there is not the support internally for all different types, but maybe particularly that contemporary pop, rock, radio-friendly Irish music. Programmers are afraid to take a chance on it, I think, because they're always looking at the next set of numbers.
Well, there you go. You hit the nail on the head. And rather than, you know, be something that legislates against that or is an adversary in any way, you know, we want to include all the radio stations, all the publishers, all the collection agencies, all the labels, you know, rather like the UK model does. And under the one umbrella, we can, you know, really work hard to fix these issues that are happening in Irish music. And like you say, you know, there are plenty, and I believe, you know, a plethora of amazing bands out there that just have no connection, can't get played, can't get things made. And for example, Greg, you know, if the budget for one Irish movie that would be gotten from the film board, and this doesn't seem like I'm having to go there, I'm looking up to the film board. I think it's an amazing thing they've done.
You don't have to de-elevate someone to elevate you. We get that. You're saying, look,
this is it.
That's working there. Let's bring us up with them.
Well, that's it. But you can make an album, you know, let's say for the budget of one movie would probably make 100 albums. You know, albums are not as expensive to make nowadays as they used to be, which is the upside of the technology end of what's happened to our industry. But the downside of that is, you know, it's very, very hard to monetize your record once you've made it. And that's another massive thing that we want to address is the monetization of artists. And I don't mean, you know, people have to reach into their pockets and pay more. I just think that if the systems are slightly changed, and we have plans to do that, you can monetize the actual creator of that art better in a way that enables them to make more art in the future, which essentially is what we want to happen.
And move more people into doing things as a passion and doing it as a living too, presumably. You talked about a UK model. What about a French model? I'm not going to keep harking on about the radio play side of things, but what about a French model whereby part of the licensing scheme, if I read it correctly, is that a percentage of music is, you know, take, if people are a wee bit nervous to give music a try, you know, legislate for them to have a certain amount of their playlist having to be, you know, Irish music. Is that, I mean, obviously you're trying the carrot, but maybe the carrot's been tried and it's stick time.
Well, yeah, we're well spotted there, Greg, as I've said that in the past. I do believe more in the carrot than the stick approach. You know, I do believe in that primarily. However, what I would say to you is it's my understanding that radio licenses in Ireland have that stipulation already that they must play, you know, 30% Irish music. Now, is that the spirit of the law or the letter of the law? So if we were to say, and again, radio stations, I'm not picking on radio stations either, because a lot of them have, you know, Irish radio shows, the Irish Hour, all of that kind of thing, which is great. But, you know, we have such, to answer your question about the French model, it's slightly different to ours, because what they're claiming is that a certain percentage of their radio play must be in their own language because they're French. So in other words, a radio station can't come on and just play American music all day.
But it has the same effect. But I understand what you're saying.
So that's what I mean. So, but in Ireland, you know, we, as I said, we punch well above our weight, and we create really global, you know, world-beating radio records too, as well as all the other stuff that we do. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to be a massive loss as to how to get these bands through, get them funded, get them out there and have a robust, you know, indigenous industry here, like you say, Greg, that gets them played, that gets them paid, and enables them to keep doing what they're doing.
Well, we can kind of get an insider think into the sort of attitude of the state in relation to this, because during or post COVID or whatever it was, there was a significant round of funding put out to support Irish music. I looked down through it, and all the names I expected to see there were there, and then some names that you would expect to see weren't there. Like, do you have a good recollection of that? Do you think you know that there was a good spread of that money that recognised that the powers that be understand the music industry?
Well, that's I could be here all day talking about that, Greg, because I kind of lived right through it for the guts of 2.5 years. But, you know, a lot of the grants that were given, I presume you mean through the Arts Council and that kind of thing, it tended to go to pretty much the same cohort of people. And again, as I said all the way through it, congratulations to them and happy days. And that's a brilliant idea. And a grant that's given, for example, okay, you want to go make a record, there's whatever, 8 or 10 grand to go and do that. And then once you've done it, what happens after that? And then what we found anyway, that the grants that were given to us in our genre were basically business expenses. And that was the MIBAS scheme. So, I mean, I know lots of other contemporary artists like myself that applied for Arts Council grants and didn't get them. Now, again, for whatever reason that is, that's up to the Arts Council how they give away their money. That's their right to do that. But it would be disingenuous to think that the Arts Council support every genre of music.
But the reason why I asked the question is,
and nor should they be able to.
But the reason I asked that question is because that scheme and where the money went does give us an insight into where we're at and maybe where we need to go. It's not a criticism necessarily of the Arts Council. Every day is a learning day, and I presume the role of Ciaran Éireann will be to sort of maybe try and change those attitudes and what have you. I'm not saying there was any malice in it, but it just is an indication of maybe where we're at and where we need to be. And I think it's really important too for bands to, I'm not sure how we, you know, how many top quality artists we could sustain in Ireland. You know, part of success is going to be for them to spread their wings, but we as a nation have to be giving them every opportunity to do so by backing
them
here.
Well, that's it, Greg. You've hit it in a nutshell right there. So you nurture the stuff at home as far as you can get it, you know, and have, you know, processes in place where they can monetize their music. Like, streaming is a massive issue. It's a massive issue. And if you know, it's going to be a case of, well, we have to change it on a European level, well, then we have to be, you know, have enough teeth to go and do that, because it's not correct the way it is. And anybody will tell you that. It doesn't work right. So if a band were able to sustain at least making another album and playing a few gigs in Ireland and get them to that level, you're absolutely right. Now they should be able to be exported abroad and have the resources and the know-how from a body such as us to do that.
Yeah, because the truth is a lot of people might see The Voice or The X Factor or whatever as the only way to platform from point A to point Z, because the rest of the alphabet really doesn't exist well. But we have to get behind them, we have to support them. So how... Your membership, right? Are you asking musicians, all different types of musicians, those in the industry? I mean, listen, there's engineers, there's sound production people all too that you want to see be able to make a living from this as well. And they do so, I suppose, if that album is being made. But who is going to make up Ciaran Éireann? Who's listening that you want to go out and check out what you're doing?
Okay, well, there's two tiers to that. Basically, we've reached out to all the major players, i.e., you know, the big players in the industry to come on board and help us steer this thing correctly. And we're very confident that we're going to get some positive results from them, because that's where we need to start. Membership, at the moment, we're only asking people to register their support. So they can go to ciaran.ie and they can register there. It doesn't cost anything, but it's just register your support, because the more numbers we have, the easier our job is going to be. And that can be an engineer, it can be a pub owner, promoter, publisher, musician, any kind of musician, just anybody that wants to come and register to support for the time being. And then as the organization progresses and develops, a larger role will be played by the registrants, as it were.
And finally, I don't want to be negative, and maybe I'll try and be positive after this question. You know, there's some people, particularly around our part of the world here in the Northwest, that have reputations for bringing on new talent, for giving them a platform, for seeing that there needs to be another generation coming through and use their stage to give them their opportunity. But broadly speaking, do you need the big guys to buy into this as well, to maybe prepare to share a little bit of their cake or limelight? Do you know what I mean? If you could get top to bottom involvement, I think that gives it credibility. If one of those top artists goes, you know what, I agree with what they're saying there. I'm not saying they're not buying in, but I think it's critical that they do.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And as I say, I'm not talking, you know, the big players as in musicians also. I mean, you know, collection agencies, record labels, promoters. You're exactly right. So we're starting at the top and at the bottom. So at the bottom, we're asking people to register their support, come on board. We'll keep them informed of what's going on. And equally at the top, we are approaching them, because they must be part of it. Because, as you know yourself, Greg, it's not going to succeed unless we have at least the blessing of all involved.
Yeah, and you know, we are lucky enough to have amazing talent of all ages up here, but I think particularly for the young ones in this context, and they come in here, Dave, and they perform live, and I swear, if someone got behind the track that had influence, guaranteed number one nationally. Do you know what I mean? I'm not being parochial on this. I mean, there's,
no,
some,
I understand.
There's some absolutely bangers that come here that are better than anything that else that's out there. And they're plugging away. They get it up on the streaming sites and they've got it on YouTube and it goes maybe semi-viral and stuff. But if they just had a push from someone with influence, it would open so many doors for them because the talent, the songwriting, the composition is there. It's just they need that step.
Well, nobody better than you, Greg. There you go. Anecdotally, that's your experience. You deal with this every day. You see people coming that are brilliant, and they just what can be done for them? There's no access to funding. So you say if they went semi-viral with something, let's say on streaming or YouTube, and the streaming rate was correct. Right, well, then they're thinking, okay, now I have a bit of a budget, yeah, and, you know, here's what you do with that. And even people with influence, as you say, I mean, that's exactly what it needs to have. It just needs to give people, exactly like the people you're talking about there, an equal fighting chance, which I believe they do, like you just said. They're even better. You know, it's not like a fighting chance. This is not a handout. This is a leg up for people who are absolutely brilliant.
They just need the shop window because the product is there. Yeah, all right. Okay, yeah. Dave, where do people go to check out more? To sign in the first instance to say, right, okay, there's something here. I think we could do something as a collective here. As you say, it's not a union. It's a collection of like-minded individuals. Where do people go?
It's www.kilaren.ie. And you can just the register now badge is on the homepage.
All right, good luck to you. Well done.
Thanks very much for having me on, Greg. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. 086 60 25,000 WhatsApps and texts to that number or call an 07491 25,000. All right, do you want to get into someone's good books for Valentine's Day? I mean, you'll blow their socks off. Why don't you take them to Glasgow at the start of May with us here at Highland Radio? Because our Highland Fling in Glasgow is flinging and flying out the door. People booking all the while to travel with us in luxury coach transport for a beautiful few days in 4-star accommodation in the Crown Plaza Hotel. Breakfast and dinner, entertainment each evening. Monday, 1st of May, there's a dance with David James. Don't let that put you off. And the Ryan Turner Band and other guests as well. On Tuesday, the 2nd of May, there's a concert with Declan Ernie and more. Wednesday, the 3rd of May, Robert Mazzell. What's included? Your transfers, as I say, your 4-star accommodation. You get your breakfast, you get your dinner, you get space during the day if you want to do whatever you want. There's facilities in the hotel to pamper yourself, or you can go out and explore Glasgow as it's really close to the buzz of Glasgow. So all you have to do if you want to book that for someone, as I say, be a lovely Valentine's Day present or a birthday present or whatever it is a €100 deposit secures your place today. Now, the places are limited, right? There's still good availability, by the way. I'm not saying otherwise, but they are going to go, and I don't want you to miss out if this is something you want to do for someone. The trip itself is €575 per person sharing, but that's all in terms of your travel, breakfast and dinner, and your accommodation and all the entertainment. As I say, Monday night's going to be great with David and the Ryan Turner Band. Tuesday, Declan Ernie and more. Wednesday, Robert Mazzell. Then there's going to be sessions in the bars and loads of fun. If you've been on these trips before, you know what they're like. If you haven't, you'll make friends for life as well. And you'll get to enjoy the company of the Highland team as well. So you can pay €100 today to secure a place for yourself or another person, the two of you, and then pay in if you wish up until departure date or a time beforehand and if it's looked forward to. So if you want more details or to reserve your place before they are gone, get in touch with us here, 074-91-25,000, 074-91-25,000. Right, now, we've heard similar calls on this programme before to this, but this is somewhat different, and it comes from Nancy Creedon, a canine behavioural expert. Good morning to you, Nancy.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you for joining us. We should know, I suppose, us humans are incredibly complex, aren't we? We are all different. We certain things make us happy, other things make us angry. Some of us can control our tempers. Some of us may snap only once in our lifetime. Others find it difficult to control our temper. Yet we don't really, I think a lot of us, maybe even dog owners, don't really look at dogs and think, well, you know what, maybe they're like humans. Maybe, you know, they have behavioural changes.
Yeah, you're spot on. And you know what, it's almost as though there's zero tolerance for dogs to feel any sort of emotion other than to be the perfect family pet. And obviously, of course, they are animals. They are individuals. They are living beings. They have their own likes and dislikes. They have their own personalities. And as they are living closer and closer to us, as our dogs are living in our homes, sleeping in our beds, what we're forgetting about is the fact that they are dogs. And when I say they are dogs, that doesn't mean they're some crazy, wild, psychotic animal. It means that they do have their own needs and wants to carry out normal dog behaviours. And critically important, they have their own language. And when we're looking at dogs and dog behaviour and behaviour problems, quite often a lot of the issues are derived simply from a lack of communication between dog and human. In the same way as you're speaking, spending time with someone who speaks a different language, it is going to be a barrier. So with a lot of, I guess, progressive owner education and general population education, fundamental to that is helping people understand dogs, understand that, yes, they do have good days and bad days, and understand how they're communicating.
Yeah, and have different patience levels and all that kind of stuff. And as well, to sorry to keep making the analogy with humans, but, you know, there's parents listening out there that had a child, best in the world, not a bother with them. New baby comes into the house. All of a sudden, that child feels threatened. Their personality changes. You know, they might nip the child when you're not looking. Who's to say? Again, you know, I don't think maybe sometimes people might consider you could expect the same behavior from a dog. They are a being. They think, you know, we presume that, oh, they're very good natured. I'm only given one example that could trigger some change of behavior that someone might expect and could have really bad consequences.
Yeah, and even as you mentioned, you know, toddlers getting upset when a new baby comes into the house and potentially biting. I mean, I once randomly met a girl at a social outing who came up to me and showed me she had a little scar on her finger from when I bit her as a child. So, I mean, I didn't get put down or sent off to the dog pound. But very much so, when changes happen in the home, it will impact the dog. And when I meet so many expectant parents thinking that, oh, the dog is going to love my baby because he loves us. Two dogs, a newborn baby is extremely like a prey item. So it smells like perhaps a rabbit or a little feral animal. It looks like it. It sounds like it. And failing to prepare is preparing to fail when it comes to newborn babies and bringing dogs home.
And we can't presume either. Sorry, Nancy, we'll get onto that too, but I just want to add something else onto that. And you can correct me if I'm wrong too. We presume that it looks at it as simply a little version of us. I mean, we don't know what a dog looks at a baby as.
Exactly. Now where life would be utopia would be if all young puppies were socialized around newborn babies and young babies, and then if during that puppy period where true socialization is occurring, if they built relationships insofar as knew how to interact with little babies and children at that age, then yes, as adult dogs they would continue to know that is kind of one of those things that I live with. That's not a toy, that's not a wild animal. However, when you have an adult dog and you bring home the baby, initially if you've not prepped, it is a strange, scary, and potentially play item as well. So what I've made is a free online course called Is Your Dog Expecting Your Baby? And it's free of charge on credencecollege.ie, but it's filled with every single thing you need to do probably from around the second trimester to start getting your dog prepped. And what it is it's clearing up the misunderstandings, it's dispelling the myths that are out there, and it's my attempt to stop people from getting the wrong information. I'm forever seeing people bringing newborn babies home and putting the car seat on the floor, or the dog's jumping up on the couch beside the baby, or the dog's face is right on top of the newborn baby. And for all I can picture is that baby will give out a squeal and the dog will do exactly what it would do to a squeaky toy. And that does happen. We've had, as we know, we've had our own fatality here in Ireland of the little newborn baby in 2021. We've had two fatalities of little newborn babies in the UK. One was killed by Jack Russell, one killed by a little Patterdale Terrier. So newborn babies, regardless of the size of the dog, newborn babies are very much at risk if you don't do your prep work.
Not to mention as well, dogs eat poo, lick the poo off themselves. And that's very dangerous to young people particularly as well, because there can be some microbes or whatever the phraseology within that as well. So even that in and of itself would make me cautious about close proximity. Maybe you're overly cautious, but anyway.
Yeah, And even on the topic of poo, it's the smell of baby poos, the smell of newborn nappies really stimulates dogs. I know even my own dog, when my sister had her baby, my dog ended up getting into the bin and destroying two big old dirty nappies, which was horrendous at the time. But that's where we'll often see the dogs become almost quite predatory. When I watch videos online of dogs sticking their noses into, like, by the baby's bum and pushing around there, that's the dog almost like, you know, pushing a hedgehog on the road and trying to get him moving. So all these subtle signs that people are missing. The thing is, like, what I would love to see is mandatory tests and assessments before you get a dog license. And it's not because I'm saying that, you know, the people of Ireland are clueless when it comes to the dogs. But what I am saying is I've spent the last 15 years studying dogs and dog behaviour. 15 years ago, what I thought to be true about dogs is actually incorrect, and a lot of my understandings were based on assumptions. There was no data behind it, and now I know better. And all I want to do is help people know better when it comes to understanding their dogs and their dog behaviour, and when there's potential bite risks, just to keep everybody safe.
Yeah,
you know, that's my agenda.
I know it's been characterised as sort of like a theory test, but look at, you know, because of cars are dangerous, right? But cars are fantastic as well. But they can cause death and serious injury. We have testing to ensure that we are capable and what have you to operate them. Are you suggesting something similar before you get to purchase a dog, a theory test to ensure that this great thing, because this is about protecting the animals as well, by the way, it's not the big bad wolf either, it's to make sure people understand their pets and that they have the best chance as well. Would you go as far as a theory type test before you can own a dog?
That is exactly what I'm calling for. Because like you said, getting behind the wheels of a car, regardless of the size of the car, you can do a lot of damage. Owning a dog, regardless of the size, regardless of the breed, owning a dog... And
okay, the phone line's dropped there. It will come back, though.
Scheme. It's not. It doesn't have to be expensive. It can be included in the licensing fee. It can be run through the current dog driving theory tests as well. And it will cover all of the information that I'm regularly teaching to dog owners. And the dog owners walk out the door saying, wow, I never knew that. Now I understand my dog so much better. And that knowledge changes completely how you work with your dog. And with that knowledge, by default, you're just going to understand your dog better. You're going to spot signs of warning signs a lot quicker, and your dog will be much happier. The owners will be much happier. And if you go in and you do your theory test and you knew all that information already, then happy days, you know? So if you think you know all you know about dogs and that you are a dog expert, then, you know, put your money where your mouth is, sit down and get your pens out and do the exam. It wouldn't be something that would be set out to trick people. It's set out to educate. It's all about education and science-based education, because between the TikToks and the Instagrams and the unqualified quote-unquote dog trainers that are popping up everywhere, there's a lot of bad information is coming back into the dog owning population that was gone over the last 10-15 years. We were getting really good at making sure that people were using, you know, positive reinforcement based training, science based training, understanding the dog's body language and so on. But now, because there's such a growing number of dogs, there's a big demand for any content to do with dogs and access to dog trainers. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people jumping into the industry without doing the courses and without gaining the experience, and that are giving out bad and dangerous advice. So that's why if there was a state-run educational body, ideally through that theory test option, the government, the Irish government, is protecting the citizens by providing them with the right information, and that would then dispel all the incorrect myths that are out there.
And finally, Nancy, can I suggest dog lovers embrace this? Because, you know, I think it's sometimes it's like someone criticising your children. People can have this instant reaction whereby you get... But the way this country is going at the moment, between people complaining about dogs on beaches or walkways, there's a big... people are almost embarrassed to go out with their dog now. Obviously, the farming community very angry with the amount of sheep kills and what have you, sheep worrying. And then we have these really high-profile, very emotive and rightly so cases where people are being very seriously injured. And, like... owning a dog, I actually, this is probably a bit crazy, but I think if dog owners don't start embracing initiatives like this, owning a dog could become very toxic very soon, I think. I think that's the direction of traffic in this country. And I think it's up to dog owners maybe to say, right, okay, maybe we'll meet you halfway. Because as I say, particularly from contacts to for this program and others, you know, some people are actually afraid to go to a beach that other people might be on, even when they have a dog in a lead, because public attitude amongst non-dog owners, it's getting really hard line.
Yeah, do you know what? And that's such a good point that I hadn't thought of and hasn't been risen to me before as well. But you're spot on. You're absolutely spot on. And dog owners should be saying, how can we prove that we are being responsible? And my big concern and one thing that really gets my goat is the fact that there are so many people who are afraid of dogs and genuinely and for good reason afraid of dogs. And then they have to deal with every time they go out to the park, there's dogs there. Every time they go to the beach, there's dogs there. And that's not fair on them. So like you said, having dog owners step up and saying we all want to be responsible, give us the right information and we'll follow it, is rightly so what they should be proud to want to do, you know. Like I teach dog behaviour and I teach people to become dog trainers and dog behaviourists, and they're spending thousands to come and learn how to care for dogs correctly and how to train dogs. So this theory test will be free access to really important information, so more than ever now it should definitely be embraced so that we can progress, we can go forward on the right path. Because if we don't do something now, mark my words, these fatalities are going to start going boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. When I did research into dog bites in Ireland back in 2015, at the time, we had no recorded fatalities in Ireland in 2015. By the time, and when I was publicising the research, I kept saying to all the media outlets, look, a fatality is coming, a fatality is coming. By the time the paper was published, we had our first fatality in 2017, and since then we've had another one in 2018, 2021, and it's going to start becoming almost an annual event. So we need to do something now. And as a mum primarily, that's why I'm so passionate about bite prevention. It's not about saving the dogs. It's not about, you know, I'm not out here, you know, waving a flag for pit bulls. I'm saying that banning and restricting breeds isn't effective, isn't fair, and isn't scientific. Education is the way forward to 100%. Minimize these.
And
events.
I'll tell you, while people with their other breed of dogs are looking at these in inverted commas dangerous dogs, it'll be your dog classes that very soon, unless something changes here,
exactly.
Because society can drastically change, and that's been proven. Nancy Creedon, thank you for your time this morning.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Greg.
Bye-bye. Now, we mentioned this briefly yesterday, some findings of a survey, and we're going to dig a little bit deeper into it now, because Paula Leonard, National League Community Action on Alcohol, Alcohol Forum Ireland, joins us. Good morning to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good, good. Now, your group was amongst those who appeared before the Justice Committee at the end of last month, and presumably having your input into the sale of alcohol bill, which greatly liberalises, really, I suppose, the unlicensed sale of alcohol. How were you received? What points did you want to get across in this committee? When I say you, I mean not as an individual, but sort of as a collective.
I suppose as the only national organisation working with communities across Ireland, it was really important for us to bring the concerns of communities to the discussion on the sale of alcohol bill. And I suppose it's really important to understand that this bill has been brought forward by the Department of Justice and that there are very particular conditions in relation to how we can sell alcohol, because it's a restricted substance for a reason, because of its, you know, its link to harm, its risk of addiction. It can be something that people become dependent on, and it's responsible for huge amounts of social and family-based harms in this country. So for us, it was really important to look at, well, what do people think about this? What do ordinary people, you know, across the country think about this? And we commissioned a Red Sea poll. And what we found really was that 74% of people in this country, you know, really strongly felt that this is a huge and significant piece of legislation. It is going to have big implications for the social, cultural life of Ireland, and that there needs to be more time given to consulting with the public, letting them know what the implications of this are, and having conversations like this in the media and elsewhere, and pausing what the department are doing. There's a lot of fear that the Department of Justice are rushing this through. And when we came out of the...
Question on that, Paula, because this kind of came out of the blue, really, did it? I mean, like, I wasn't hearing publicans and licensees screaming from every street corner that we need to stay open till this time, and we need to liberalise the laws in relation to this, and we need to make it easier to get a booze licence, you know.
Yeah,
it just came like a train.
Really important. I think that's a really important point. this has been sold, you know, by the Department of Justice as something that was going to revitalise the nighttime economy across Ireland. There is concern that we've seen 20% of all pubs in this country have closed. There is concern that, you know, 75% of nightclubs in this country has closed. But we fundamentally do not believe that this act in the form that it's in at the moment is going to deliver what government set out to do. And one of the things that government set out to do and clearly claimed their objective was to protect young people from alcohol harm. They're not going to achieve that with this law in the way it's configured. But vintners are actually quite concerned about some of the proposals in the legislation.
And we'll get
as well
to that. But what I find remarkable about this is that these pubs closed, right? Their licences have been bought up by off licences. So we're actually having more outlets where people can drink at home. So rather than address that, sort of say, right, okay, people are boozing at home now. We're going to make more licences now so people don't booze at home. They you know what I mean? So we just park that and say, right, we've got off licences everywhere. That's where all the pub licences went. And I'm not sure how many people actually realise that out there. And now what we're going to do is liberalise the licensing law so people can serve more drink in more places on-site for longer periods of time, which does absolutely nothing to address a problem with how people are drinking in this country.
No, and I think, you know, a couple of things. 65% of all of the alcohol drank in this country is now purchased in off licences for home consumption. And really, the Department of Justice set about this piece of legislation very quickly and said it was there to solve that problem. However, they're opening off licences an hour earlier. They're liberalising the regime and they're getting rid of the extinguishment requirement, which anyone who lives in rural Ireland would know that there were a certain number of licences in the country and that you could only, you know, buy one when one was closing. But getting rid of the extinguishment requirement is something the trade is very concerned about. Because, for example, you may have a small rural village in Donegal that has two pubs currently. They don't want to stay open to the extended hours of 2 o'clock. And a Witherspoons can now open up on the corner and could have them closed down within 6 months. Now, that is an argument that's been made by some of the smaller pubs and vintners across this country. And I think that needs to be heard. But for us as an organisation that is on the front in terms of seeing and working with and supporting families that are impacted by alcohol harm, we're very concerned about the implications that there are contained in this bill for children, for children's rights and for the exposure of children to alcohol and alcohol harm. So, for example, there's been no consideration given to closing the loophole that has allowed, you know, the large teenage discos to operate without having child protection statements. There has been no consideration given to the fact that they've removed the 15-year-old age bracket at which you can stay at a private function on licensed premises. So you now could have a baby or a 2-3-year-old child staying at a private function where alcohol has been sold until 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and in the last couple of minutes, we have this situation where things like that are changing here, and yet over in Canada, they've new guidelines out whereby, and they would prefer to say zero drinks, but their limit 2 drinks per week. That is the advice there. So can you imagine a Canadian over there listening to that, flying into Ireland, and then they see what we're doing in a completely different direction. We've done nothing about labelling, nothing about pointing out the carcinogenic problems, you know, the increase in breast cancer and all different types of cancers. We're going, ignoring that and going in a different... I'm no prude, I like a drink, don't get me wrong, I'll put my cards on the table there, but, you know, there's something going on here. Who are the Department of Justice working on behalf of, really?
I think that's a really important question. There was a nighttime economy task force set up by government. There are concerns about, you know, having a vibrant nighttime economy in Ireland. There were arguments made the other day by also members of the committee. Why aren't we looking at developing nightlife in this country that's friendly for families? Why aren't we opening up theatre spaces and exhibition spaces?
Make it easy to open a cinema. Give them preferential treatment for planning.
Yeah, why aren't we doing these things?
I know teenagers that want to do something else, but there's nothing to do but booze.
Yeah, so on the Nighttime Economy Task Force, just to take you back in terms of the story and how quickly this is happening.
In a minute, Paula, and I won't interrupt, sorry.
No, you're okay. It's just there were no health representatives. There were no health representatives involved in that. There was no HSE, no Department of Health, no health advocates, no alcohol charities, no people working with or representing families impacted by alcohol harm. And then the Minister for Justice brought this very quickly before to the Cabinet to get approval, got approval, the Minister for Health failed to name the fact that his own department had provided him with a memo that said there are serious health implications for this. And this has been rushed through. But what we did feel at committee the other day was that there was an acknowledgement that we need to pause and that we need to consider the evidence and that we need to have a look at this and relook at this, because it's going to have huge implications for how this country behaves and for how much it's going to cost us to mop up alcohol harm in our communities.
And it's a huge pressure on, well, for a lot of people die, firstly, but secondly, a lot of people end up sick, and it's huge resources to try and make them better. Paula Leonard, as always, thank you very much indeed. Have a lovely day. Paula Leonard, National Lead, Community Action on Alcohol, Alcohol Forum Ireland. That's where we have to leave it on the programme today. Thank you very much for listening and getting involved in the conversation. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock with the Friday panel, Michael and Fionnuala, and so much more besides. But for me, Greg Hughes, and Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, have a wonderful Thursday.